Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. JJ Devaney here, flying the plane while Andrew Gundling takes a well-deserved vacation in New Jersey. What's going on, my man?
Hey, what's up, brother? Wow, that's very kind of you. You've never said that. You've always exclusively criticized my vacations and mocked my commitment.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not fair because I opened the show the last time we did this and I just said, Andrew, phoning it in again. And it was really unfair. Yeah. So I thought I'd get off to a positive start and recognize all the great work you do for this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the number of moments in life that I've missed because of doing this podcast while on vacation. I think Jack's first words, his first steps. What's that? He's doing math problems? Oh, he does math now, but I'm missing it, JJ. I'm here.
Yeah, don't go too far, okay? That's a little bit much because your commitment to this podcast is fantastic. It has not, however, meant that you've missed a single moment of Jack's wonderful life, so don't even do that.
Hallmark moments.
Don't lay that guilt trip on me. Listen, big show. Thank you for doing this. I really do appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners will too. Bit of an interesting weekend in the Premier League. We're going to talk about that. There was a record broken in MLS, or equaled rather. We're going to talk about that as well. The usual, we've got a mailbag, red cards, man of the match, all the good stuff. So even when Andrew goes on vacation, the podcast does not. But let's begin, I suppose, with Manchester United at the weekend, Andrew. And this morning, Twitter's got this function where it will tell you if somebody hasn't tweeted in a while. And they've suddenly tweeted. And that sudden tweet this morning was from Mino Raiola, who decided to, how would I put this, respond to Paul Scholes' general comments over the weekend about Manchester United's defeat away at Brighton. And this is what he had to say to Paul Scholes directly. Some people need to talk for fear of being forgotten. Paul Scholes wouldn't recognise a leader if he was in front of Sir Winston Churchill. He then followed on with a second tweet almost immediately after. Paul Scholes should become sports director and advise Woodward to sell Pogba. Would be sleepless nights to find Pogba a new club. So, yeah, Mino Raiola is weighing in on what has been another, I suppose, fraught weekend for Manchester United.
Here's the tweet that I find most meaningful, and it's not from Mino Raiola. It's Gary Neville responding to Mino Raiola's tweets, and he says, "Let's hope at Paul Pogba leads his agent and shuts him up." That's really the one I agree with. I kind of almost feel bad for Pogba in this because it really doesn't feel like Pogba is instructing his agent to do this. This feels like Mino Raiola has gone rogue, and I don't know what the end game is here. Is this his way of trying to force a move? Because I don't see Manchester United selling Paul Pogba at this stage in the game when they can't get anyone back with the window having closed in England. So all he's doing is just shedding more negative light on his client. And it's, I don't know who this helps.
I'm not so sure either. We should probably give some context to this because this is what Paul Pogba had to say in his post-match comments after the defeat to Brighton.
Paul, how disappointed is the mood in that dressing room right now?
Disappointed, but you know, I think everybody knows all the players. Trust me, you know, we don't. The way that we play, I don't think we deserve to win because of the attitude that we made on the pitch. 2-1, 2-0, 2-1. We tried and we made mistakes and created the goals. Then after the other chances, we pushed, but we scored a goal, I think, a bit too late. And the result is how it is, I think, is how it is, and I don't think we deserve to win today with the way that that we play, and I think we know it.
So Pogba talks about attitude, which was, I mean, a lot of people have hailed him for being honest, for being, you know, taking some responsibility. And Scholes had this to say working for BT Sports. I hope that is lost in translation. There is no defense for that comment. There is no defense for it. You say to yourself, don't you? You're constantly saying to yourself, attitude, right? Make sure it's right. You don't need other people to tell you. You don't need a manager to tell you that or your teammates. So basically Scholes is saying, okay, you want to talk about Jose Mourinho, etc., etc., fine, the way he sets his team up, the way the team sets out to play. That's okay, but players should have attitude. Players should show the right attitude. That, you know, he's kind of incredulous with what Pogba has said.
I agree with, look, fundamentally, I agree with Paul Scholes. Like, that is 100% correct. These are athletes who are paid millions and millions of dollars. Like, that is the one thing that you should always be able to have control of is your attitude going into a game.
Right.
However, it does feel a little bit inhuman for Paul Scholes to just expect that every player is robotic in that way. Maybe he was, and maybe that's what made him the legend that he is. But like, you know, to act like it's unthinkable that players could ever go out or go into the game with the wrong mindset, with a negative mindset. I mean, like that does happen. I'm not excusing it, but like to act so shocked that anything like that could ever come from a player's mouth, I'm not stunned to hear that. Like when Paul Pogba made those comments, it didn't cause me to start just like running laps around my house being like, oh my God, I can't believe what I've just heard. This is madness. I didn't think it was that weird.
Now, the quote that we played, or the audio I played there, was from, I think it was an interview with just the general Premier League that's disseminated around the world, the general Premier League post-match. But in his Sky Sports post-match, he said something that was much more damning and much more pointed. And Pogba suggested that Brighton, Andrew, had prepared better than United had for the game. He said maybe Brighton's preparation was better. That to me is damning. And that to me is pointed towards the manager.
Well, and that's where, I mean, that's where this is headed, right? Like the Pogba-Raiola stuff is all just sort of a precursor to what is really going on here, and it's about the manager.
Absolutely, 100% it's about the manager. Also, I think, I mean, Mino Raiola, you got to think before you tweet, and Raiola tweets every few months, so he gives us these little nuggets. Paul Scholes wouldn't recognize a leader if he was in front of Sir Winston Churchill. Like, Paul Scholes played in a midfield alongside Roy Keane, one of the greatest leaders United have ever had. So when Paul Scholes speaks about leadership, he's, you know, he's got some weight in that argument. He knows what it takes.
Of course. And I think people thought he was a leader in his own right. So, I mean, he would know.
Yeah.
Of course he would know.
I think what happened.
But I don't know how well he knows Paul Pogba. I mean, because like, everything we heard during the World Cup, was a leader on that French side that just won the title. So I don't know. Honestly, like both Raiola going back and forth with Scholes, like, it's all just kind of annoying to me. None of that matters.
Yeah, I don't think it matters either, to be quite honest with you. And I also think that it's kind of a smokescreen, because if you're focusing on Paul Pogba alone in this team, then you're probably looking at the wrong things. Look at the two central defenders. You know, £60 million worth of defender in Lindelof and Eric Bailly. Look how poor they were. And they were both the manager signings.
Well, this is the thing that I wanted to ask you about specifically. So Jose Mourinho is upset, presumably, because United haven't gone out and gotten him the central defenders that he wanted. Maybe United haven't done that because the central defenders that Jose initially wanted have turned out to not work in the way that he felt. So they feel they can't trust him to go and do that. But then I keep going back and forth in my mind because I think to myself, well, that's unfair for a club to expect a manager to get 100% of his signings correct.
Okay.
Like every club has that. I mean, I've seen Pochettino get signings wrong with Sissoko and things like that, but it doesn't mean that I don't trust him to ever sign another player again. So I feel like it's unfair of Ed Woodward and the Manchester United board to look at Mourinho in that light. Well, you got these central defenders wrong, so we can't trust you. But then I go back again and say, well, but then the players that Mourinho has presumably gotten right, like Pogba, he's using in the wrong ways. So I can't tell who's the most wrong here. I mean, like, has Josie lost the right to ask for players when guys he's brought in he's misused or they haven't panned out the way we thought? Is the board wrong to not even give Josie the chance to try to make up for some of the mistakes he's made in the transfer window? It just feels like every party in this whole Manchester United mess has a lot of culpability and blame. Everybody wants to blame Mourinho. People want to blame Pogba. I really think, like, every single person involved here is shouldering some level of blame for the position that they're currently in.
I agree with you. And I think it's the confluence of a few things, not just one thing, not just, hey, Mourinho plays in a certain way, his tactics are outmoded, he can't sign the right players anymore. I think it's Ed Woodward, it's the board, it's Jose Mourinho, it's also the players, because let's be honest, Chris Hughton's a fine manager, Brighton are a decent team, but that's a 34-year-old Glenn Murray that is running them ragged. And that just shouldn't happen. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't even play Yannick Kabash, didn't come off the bench. Berham Kayal came in late to the game. But, you know, this was Glenn Murray, who, let's be honest, is a championship striker, giving so much problems to that back four. There's another issue here as well, Andrew. And I think, you know, who is signing these players? Because I just had a quick look at Lindelof last season. Lindelof did not get a regular run in the team. You know, he was a quite expensive signing, I suppose, not really in modern standards, but, you know, there was a fair amount of money was paid for him, and Mourinho used him relatively sparingly. He was, you know, sometimes he didn't appear in the squad, sometimes he was back in the team, a lot of times he started on the bench. You know, is Mourinho really fully in charge of the signings at the club?
That's a great question. I was reading something where I guess the structure of Manchester United and probably a lot of clubs is that before the transfer window, the team scouting department will bring a list of their recommendations to Jose and to Woodward, and then they'll go through and decide on guys they want, and then I guess it's Woodward's job to go out and get that player. But it isn't clear as to, you know, how much say Jose has as opposed to how much say Ed Woodward has. I would like to believe that the manager does have more say, and then it's Woodward's job to go out and make the deal. But you're right. I actually don't know. And I think that's a legitimate question when you watch the way things transpire with them, with these players.
Yeah. So I feel like we're where we were last season. Me and you were talking about the exact same things with Manchester United, and this is just going to run and run. And I think you're right. I think it's a sideshow, Mineirola's tweets. We all know where this is going. And it, you know, it genuinely does feel like the clock is ticking on Mourinho again. And it was so funny, Andrew. Many of the journalists who, you know, Miguel Delaney, guys like that, who've been covering Mourinho for years and years, they all had the same thought. This is 15-16 Mourinho meltdown. And they could even pinpoint a game. Everton, the defeat to Everton 3-1 away. That was the game that they pointed to that had the most amount of, I suppose, commonality, or it was a mirror image with the defeat to Brighton at the weekend.
Yeah. And it really feels like now, that Brighton defeat has happened. And you're right. That could be the tipping point in all of this. So all of a sudden, doesn't it feel like for Jose Mourinho personally, every game now is a cup final? Like, he's got Spurs at Old Trafford coming up this on Monday. I mean, like, can he afford to lose that? Now, I don't think they're going to fire him after three games, but, you know, I feel like now we're in that place where everyone is just waiting for that final moment to push him over the edge. And, you know, to get Tottenham in a fairly difficult game so quickly after such a bad loss, he better have his team ready. If we hear the same kind of things afterwards, you know, if they lose and once again, it's, you know, they were more prepared than us, that's it. I really think he will lose people for good after that.
I think so too. I think he's going to retreat into classic Mourinho pose.
I love that.
This is going to be like Liverpool at Old Trafford last season. You're going to see him defend deep, try to get on the break. I'm sure there's people out there saying, JJ, that's what he always does. But I mean, it's going to be Rashford running into the channels, flick-ons from Lukaku. He's going to leave nothing to chance in this one. Otherwise, Andrew, like you said, you then have to wonder at what point does the shoe drop?
Well, that's fine. He can do that. But here's the thing. He better win. You can get away with playing that style if you're winning. But if it's like, it's more of this, if it's Manchester United eking out ugly 0-0 draws against competition that their fan base believes that they should be better than, you know, especially in a time where City, Liverpool, and Spurs, you know, arguably the three best teams in England, all play an open style. Like, it only magnifies what it is that Mourinho's doing and just how wrong so many people view it to be when you see his direct competition doing the complete opposite and succeeding.
Well, you talked about style and you talked about his competition. Let's talk about Manchester City because, again, if Jose Mourinho has had a bad result and then City on the same weekend go out and score six, that just amplifies things and makes things worse. You're so right. Manchester City blowing Huddersfield away and comfortably coping with the absence of Kevin De Bruyne.
I loved Aguero's first goal so much. It was like, not only does the style of play that you see from City reflect poorly on Mourinho, not to bring it back to him, but like, didn't it just feel to you like that first Aguero goal, the long kick out from Ederson, it was just like, it was just coaching at its absolute best. Like, it felt to me almost like Manchester City had been playing like the long game here. Okay, we're going to play it out from the back for years, and then when we get Huddersfield, that's when we're going to surprise them.
Yeah,
like, but and I know that sounds silly, but I really like that came straight from like the practice from the training ground. To run Aguero into space like that and just like lull everyone into believing that, okay, we're going to play it out from the back again like we always do. And then all of a sudden, Ederson can just do that and Aguero's in space and he pings it over the... I just loved that goal from beginning to end.
I love the finish of the goal. I love the beginning of the goal. I love the way the fact that every Manchester City player, it's almost like the NFL, they were mic'd up and someone put a play call out there. And this play call was 2-6, 2-6, Red Sea. So we'll part and we'll leave a perfect avenue in which Ederson can drive the ball down the field. That said, Andrew, Ederson's range of passing is unbelievable. For a goalkeeper, it's incredible. It's there's plenty of goalkeepers in the history of the game that can hit the ball a distance, really, really far. But he doesn't hit it like that. It's not one of those floated long kickouts. He pings it with pace right into, and he hits the target nearly every time.
That's why I'm almost offended as if I was a goalkeeper. But like, I'm almost offended by you even using the words for a goalkeeper. I really think that he's a tremendous passer for anyone.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't disagree with you, but we have a traditional view of goalkeepers, particularly in the English Premier League. And I'm sorry, Ederson does not fit that mold.
Right. It's like in baseball when like a catcher beats out an infield single and somebody's like, he's pretty fast for a catcher.
Right, right.
Like that's like the goalkeeper equivalent.
We kind of get into these stereotypical modes about what a goalkeeper is. And for years, Andrew, I remember one of the TV views that kind of shaped you as a young person that watching TV was, I can't believe how far the goalkeeper has kicked that from the kick out. Like it was just so, it seemed incomprehensible how a man from a small run up could smash a ball down the field like that. It was just incredible. And it was more the power and the length of it. Now it's the accuracy and the pace of the ball. It's wonderful. It's really incredible. And again, look at this Manchester City lineup. They don't even have to start their full teams for games like this.
Yeah. And look, I don't want to go crazy over that because let's be honest. It's Huddersfield, who I know I had, and I think you did too. We both had them going down this season. And B, it wasn't even really Huddersfield's top squad. I mean, they were without Aaron Moy. Congratulations to him on the birth of his child. But like, even with that aside, for City to go out there and play as well as they did without Sterling in the starting 11 and Sané and Mahrez and Walker, like, that is scary. I mean, I know it's Huddersfield and I know they were missing some of their key players, but it is still a Premier League side. And to be able to just make it look as easy as Manchester City did, it just looks to me like any thought that people had that, like what we saw with Chelsea, where they'd win a title and then they'd be 10th, or even what we saw with City in the past, where they'd win a title and they'd still be good, but it wasn't the same kind of City. I know it's so early in the season, so maybe we'll look back on me saying this is really dumb later on, but they've shown no signs, at least so far at this point, they've shown no signs of having something like that happen to them. Up to this point, they look as hungry as you would expect a Pep side to look.
And it's also worth remembering, Huddersfield did get a result at Manchester City, which helped them stay up. So it's the contrast That's between right. just a few months ago and now is incredible. The contrast between Wenger and Unai Emery is probably not as much as Arsenal fans would have liked at this point. Two defeats, Andrew. What did you think of Arsenal at the weekend?
Well, real quick, because you mentioned Emery, so I just want to start with one thing. Like, a sentiment that I've heard a little bit and one that I've seen on Twitter from a suddenly emboldened group of Wenger loyalists, which is fine. You can love him forever for what he did. But this idea of, well, Arsenal fans, this is what you wanted. Be careful what you wish for. First of all, it's been two games. Let's give Unai Emery a little bit more time than that to find out what he has here and how he wants to play. This was never going to be fixed overnight. By the way, their first two games have been against City and Chelsea. So let's all relax on judging his entire time over what we've seen in these two. But on top of that, this idea of be careful what you wished for. You wanted Wenger. I'm sorry. Was Wenger a lifetime appointment? Like, was he wronged in some way? There were people that wanted him fired 5 years ago. I think Arsenal did everything in their power to give him every chance imaginable to make it work. They had stagnated. Like, that's just the fact. Like, Wenger, it's not a lifetime job. They weren't getting better. They were going the other direction. Like, I mean, what do people want? Yeah, I get that some of the Wenger haters were a little bit too loud and a little bit too angry in the way they went about it, but it wasn't a crazy decision or an irrational decision for Arsenal, who finally decided to go the other way. So, you know, people can be upset with the start that Arsenal have gotten off to, even though I find that a little bit unfair. But my God, to be invoking Wenger's name, like, things would be so much better if he was still here. I don't see that at all.
No, I think the concern, though, Andrew, is that if you're just looking at the first two games, let's look at the start of this game in particular. To be 2-0 down so quickly, and the nature in which they conceded those goals, the shambolic defending, the high line with space in behind that just seemed to invite Chelsea onto them. I think those were the real concerns there. And also a couple of performances, like, if you look at some of the signings, Sokratis, you have to wonder. I know Sven Mislintat has a huge connection with Borussia Dortmund. I understand that he has a knowledge of Sokratis, obviously rates him, but he's had two pretty poor games. You've looked for the change. You've still seen the same goalkeeper. You've still seen the same kind of midfield. You're not okay. Guendouzi coming in has been good for the team. I think he's a young player, but he's getting a steep learning curve. But you're still seeing, I suppose, Arsenal-y kind of things, like poor defending, a midfield that's overran, and going behind early against Chelsea. I mean, that felt, it didn't feel that new. There's still the flavor. And change is going to take time. I understand that. But I think Arsenal fans wanted to see, I suppose, the team to be a bit more resolute. And they haven't seen that yet.
Fair. Those are fair points. A couple of things. First of all, the midfield is going to change, because I really believe that Granit Xhaka is on borrowed time. And the second that Torreira is like 100% match fit, I think that's it. I don't know how much Granit Xhaka we're going to see again. And the other thing, you're right, for as poorly as Arsenal did start the game, I think they do need some credit for the way that they fought back. And let's be honest, you can account for all these things and say, oh, Emery needs to do a better job. What's the deal with that signing? The midfield selections is wrong. But all of that being what it is, the one constant that you think with Arsenal is Aubameyang. You can't account for him being as poor as he was. Like, if he was even just bad in that game, Arsenal probably win or at least draw. But he was terrible.
What?
It's hard for me to place so much blame on the manager when, like, their star player performed so poorly and was in multiple situations where he could have positively impacted the game, and he never really did.
Well, there's the positives in your negative, because it's not like Arsenal didn't create chances. How many times did we see them get down the right-hand side of the Chelsea defence, get a cross, or rather a cutback, to a player in space? And I think it was Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang twice who had probably three really poor misses. And, if Arsenal aren't creating those chances, I'm much more concerned. But look at the way they conceded the goal. I'll say it again. I'm not sure that you can have Ozil and Mkhitaryan in the team. Look at Mkhitaryan, what he did for the, I think it was the opening goal or the second goal. You know, conceding possession, not getting back. If you look at also Lacazette on the,
well, yes,
what turned out
ding,
to be,
ding, ding.
What turned out to be the winner. I mean, those mistakes and those moments of concentration lapse are what have affected Arsenal in the past under Wenger. And it's just, it's not going to be that easy. Unai Emery's probably going to need a few windows before he can really change this team and make it into a team that's really molded in his image and what he wants it to be.
Yeah, the question is whether or not we live in a sports culture that will afford him that possibility, because I don't know that we do. One thing on Chelsea, because I don't want to just gloss over what has been a nice start for Maurizio Sarri, who, by the way, you know, sometimes we talk about attire of managers on the sideline. I mean, he's basically wearing Chelsea pajamas.
Right.
Are we okay with this? Like, is this just a thing that we're going to allow to have happen?
But I'm totally fine with it. This is a guy who, you know, for most of his football career, I'm sure at the start of it, definitely would have smoked in the dugout.
Yes, that's true.
He is a very, how shall I put it, he's a very old school Italian manager in both sartorially and his views on smoking. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah. My one thing that I want to actually say about Chelsea, I'm really interested by one player in particular, and that is Alvaro Morata. He took his goal so nicely in that game. It was such a good individual effort. He made Mustafi look so bad in defense. Here's the thing with him. He was written off by a lot of people at the end of last season, but let's just remember this. He scored 7 times in his first 8 appearances for Chelsea last year. Then he suffers a back injury. He tried to play through it, and he admitted afterwards that that was a mistake. He should have missed time. He should have allowed himself to heal. He then went 13 games without scoring and then became labeled as a bust for them. Maybe he's not. Maybe he really was not healthy. All the talk about Chelsea needing to have gone out and replace him, and it was a mistake that they didn't go out and get a striker to replace Morata. Let's find out, because when he was healthy last year, he was very good. So I'm kind of coming into this season with a clean slate for him.
I think that's fair. I think that's very fair. And look, just as it goes with Unai Emery, the same applies for Sarri. It's going to get time to implement a totally new style of play compared to what Antonio Conte did at Chelsea. And look, I asked at the start of the season, will Morata be able to fit into that style of play? So far, so good. I'm not sure that is eventually how Sarri's Chelsea will line up. But again, will Sarri get the time if things take a dip? I'm still not sure about Chelsea yet. I know Arsenal are a good side, but if you look at the opening goals in particular, obviously Eden Hazard didn't start. I'd want to see Chelsea at their full strength with Eden Hazard starting and see how exactly this Chelsea team's going to perform. And it needs to be a big game. I'm not saying Arsenal at the Bridge isn't a big game. It was, but the start that Arsenal afforded Chelsea and the way Arsenal came back makes me think that, you know, there's going to be tough times ahead for Sarri too, that this is, it's the second game. We have a lot more to see before we can make, definite declarations on where either of these managers are at. Liverpool.
Right, we do that next week, right?
That's right.
Jump to conclusions.
Yeah,
this week. This week is way too soon. We're going to wait one more week.
Yeah, we do 3 weeks before we start making grand proclamations about teams. Liverpool 2, Crystal Palace 0. I tweeted something that was probably a little bit silly, but I did it and it happened.
Oh.
And I'm not saying that Liverpool are going to win the championship, but
oh my God.
But this is the kind of result that you need. Liverpool played decent in spells, but they weren't by any stretch at their full maximum capabilities. There were times when mistakes were made. Naby Keita had a good game, but there was a couple of times where he gave the ball away. Liverpool played really well at times, but still it took a penalty. They were 1-0 up for most of the game right until the very end. It felt not like they were hanging on, but that Crystal Palace were very much still in the game. It was a tough, ground out 2-0 away win for Liverpool. And Andrew, it just felt like the kind of results you have to get if you're going to, well, first of all, keep pace with Manchester City. But second of all, if you are going to sustain a title tilt this season.
Boy, those Liverpool underpants are on tighter than ever, aren't they?
No.
Oh, my God.
No, I said,
I'm surprised that your legs even have circulation.
Well,
right
look,
now.
Look, it's worth pointing out that we did win at Crystal Palace last season, and it was a tough game, and I think Palace are going to be a tough game for most teams. It's just the way that when you're not playing 100% that you still get the result. Now, that said, there were some moments in the game where you're like, oh my God, Liverpool are absolutely going to blow Palace away. There was a moment where I think it was Alisson played the ball out to Keita, who turned and absolutely scorched Andros Townsend and then drove into the space in front of him and clipped a ball over the top, which created a great chance for Mo Salah, who just chipped it over the bar. And it's those moments where you're like, man, this Liverpool team has such potential. That said, it's still 1-0, the 89th minute, and Adam Lallana gives away a free kick in a dangerous position. And you're like, here we go again. The ball goes into the box. What's going to happen? But, you know, Sadio Mane finished off a good breakaway to seal the result. All I'm saying is that's the kind of result that a couple of years ago we're not getting. We're certainly not getting it under Brendan Rodgers. Early on in Klopp's reign, we weren't getting it. And now the team is seeing out these kind of games, and it's heartening for me.
Yeah, I suppose. I get what you're saying, because that is a game that last year we looked at with Liverpool that they would lose or draw. Like, they always seem to underachieve against opponents that were, for lack of a better term, beneath them. It's just funny to me that, like, if you're positive about Liverpool, like you're feeling good about them,
yeah,
then it sort of means right now that they can just do no wrong. Because when they play great, they play great. And when they play poorly, we say, oh, but they can play poorly and win. Well, like, everyone does that. That's just no team is great every week, and teams do find ways to win. So I think it's adorable right now, just how happy you are that, you know, your team is riding high, and you're loving life, and they can do no wrong in your eyes. And I think it's a beautiful love story.
Well, no, you're being smug and you're being facetious, but that's exactly the way Spurs played at the weekend. Spurs did not play well at the weekend and ground out a result against tricky opposition. That's heartening too. It's the second game in. All I'm saying is we've seen, if you look at some of the results last season against, like you said, the lesser opposition, Liverpool came up short, and that allowed City to just streak ahead in the championship, and it was over by Christmas. Speaking of Spurs, you beat Fulham. You didn't play well. Are you heartened by the result, or are you just going to take the same cold, cynical look that you took at Liverpool?
Well, no, I'm heartened by it. For one, I didn't think – you texted me during the game, and you were Kieran Trippier scored on that free kick, which looked exactly like his free kick against Croatia.
Well, no, it didn't. It was exactly
the same.
No, it was
superimposed one and put it in another field at another time.
One of our listeners tweeted the exact same thing, and I had to shut him down. And he went back.
Genius.
He went back and he looked at it, and that free kick against Fulham was even better. Obviously, the context of the moment means that the Croatia one will live longer in the memory, but that one against Fulham at the weekend was much better. It was to the left, and it was further out, and it was right in the corner. It was wonderful.
Yeah, but like I texted you, I was like, oh, what a goal, like Croatia all over again. And you texted me something back like, oh, they're still playing like S. And I was like, oh, that was not the response I expected.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was certainly a stretch around the time when Mitrovic scored. Fulham definitely went through a patch in that game where they looked really good. But overall, I didn't think Tottenham were that bad.
I just thought in that first half in particular, the ball switched out. Like the one, okay, Fulham were sitting off, obviously, which makes it difficult. But I think, you know, Tottenham just seemed kind of a little bit one-paced. The same thing would happen. They'd collect the ball. They'd turn to the right-hand side. Invariably, they'd pass the ball out towards Trippier, who would get it and look to swing it round the fullback. He wouldn't attack the space in behind, and it just kept happening and happening. And not much really came of it. It took a moment, really. And a superb moment from Lucas Moura to really kind of get Spurs going. And that was just a piece of individual brilliance. I just thought Spurs were a little bit off it.
I guess. I mean, Lucas Moura, I love that he scored, because, you know, I'm like one of his biggest supporters. I think he's like in the flashes and the moments that he gets, I think he's been really good. So I'm glad that he's getting a chance now. But he missed a free header early on in that game that could have given them an early lead. I mean, they scored three in the end. I'm glad that Kane was able to break his August drought. I guess overall for me, it's more of a bigger picture thing, in that all the talk about them off the field, between the stadium stuff and the lack of activity in the transfer window, there's been so much negative stuff away from the game. And you sometimes forget that, like, they're still a very good side. And, two wins from their first two. I think it's the kind of start that they, it was important that they got off to this to try to suppress some of the negativity that surrounds them right now.
Newcastle and Cardiff played out a 0-0, Andrew, and Rafa's concerns are appearing to be justified.
Yeah, the only thing that I thought about this game was that, Kennedy really did not take advantage of an opportunity. And I don't just mean his penalty attempt at the end of that game, because it was a pretty poor attempt. But I mean, he should have been red carded earlier in that game. And absolutely, he was lucky to have been there. And now he finds himself center stage at the end with a chance to win. And it was like one of those ball don't lie situations. Like the soccer gods knew, no, you should not be here right now. We can't allow this. And the rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, Cardiff played okay. They're very combative. I mean, if you say Kennedy could have been sent off, Harry Arthur easily could have been sent off for Cardiff. It looks like it's going to be even tougher for Rafa to work the Oracle again this season and somehow keep this team in the league. Andrew, I think they're going to be in a relegation battle to the end.
I think you might be right. I wasn't sure of that, but, well, you know what? I'm not going to say that yet. It's two games. I'm not going to say that yet.
So, Andrew, you have prepared a wonderful what to watch for us.
Yeah, as always, we start with MLS because there is some midweek action, and it's prominent midweek action because, JJ, this is rivalry week. Yes. Wednesday, 7 o'clock, a nice Wednesday night New York derby to look forward to. I love it. NYCFC and the Red Bulls, they've each won one against each other so far this season. Maxi Morales scored pretty late on the last time that they met. To spoil Chris Armas's first derby between these two. Typically, the Red Bulls, I don't know. I'm very curious about this game because I feel like both teams are pretty good. And NYCFC, I feel like we're starting to see like greater aspirations from them on a grander scale, although they're coming off a loss at the weekend. So both teams may be hitting this game at an interesting time. Now here's the one real quick that we haven't talked a lot about this, but now things are starting to happen. So I did want to get your thoughts. Thursday, 7 o'clock, Chicago Fire and Columbus Crew. And this has nothing to do with the game, but sadly, it's starting to feel more and more like an inevitability that the Crew are going to be leaving Columbus. The Austin City Council passed a vote of 7-4 for the building of a soccer-specific stadium in the northern part of the city. And so now, I guess, JJ, it comes down to this. If you give me a sec here, I'm going to read from something I saw in Deadspin. They did a whole feature on this. This is from the article in Deadspin. They say, after Art Modell moved the Browns to Baltimore in 1995, the state enacted a law that requires any pro sports team that uses a tax-supported facility to provide 6 months' notice before any potential relocation and to allow a local investor or the city the opportunity to purchase the team. The Art Modell law has been the main crux of a lawsuit filed by Ohio's Attorney General Mike DeWine and the city of Columbus to block relocation. So there is a law in Ohio that essentially gives Ohio-based teams a last-ditch effort to be saved, which if you're a Columbus supporter, you think, oh, my God, this is great news. Now we just need like some white knight to ride in and save us. Here's the thing. It's a long shot. For one, the law appears, if you look at the law and you believe those who talk about the law, it's really, really vague. So if this goes to court, it can be fought, and chances are those who want to move the team pre-court, they'll win. And two, this is again from Deadspin. They say the Modell law also may be unconstitutional, interfering with federal protections on interstate commerce. This portion of the Constitution was invoked by a Louisiana judge in 1979, which allowed the Jazz to move to Utah, despite the fact that the team was contractually obligated to stay in New Orleans. So when things like this have gone to court before, it doesn't end well for the city that is trying to keep their team. So maybe there is a bit of a last-ditch effort element to this, but if I'm a betting man, I still feel like this is trending towards Columbus leaving Columbus and going to Austin, which to me is sad because franchise relocation is a thing that sickens me.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mention it because I just watched NFL Films. It's called Cleveland 95, and it's about that tumultuous season where the Browns, mid-season, when they were actually, I think they started out 4-0 under Bill Belichick, and then Art Modell decided, well, we're moving the team. And what it did to the city, what it did to the fan base, was just, it was really, really sad. It's a very good watch. Once again, NFL Films, just so insightful and really, really sad. And It seems as if Ohio is it's got such history in this. I wonder, will Columbus Crew fans react the same way that the not that I'm encouraging it, but Columbus Crew, I think they, sorry, the Cleveland Browns played, oh, I think it was the Oilers in their final game, and they just literally ripped up the stadium in like this emotional showing. They took out the seats, they threw them onto the field, and then the dog pound, which was the hardcore, I guess, the ultras of the Cleveland Browns, they all kind of embraced the players at the end, and hugs were given out, and tears, and it was just this cauldron of emotion and sadness. And I'm wondering, will the hardcore support of Columbus Crew feel that way?
Yeah, the thing I wonder, when the Browns moved, it felt like it was really stunning. So I think there was more of an anger associated with that. Whereas this with the Columbus Crew, this has been going on now for a while.
Yeah.
So while there is anger, I feel like this one, the tone is a little bit more of like a sad acceptance. Whereas the Browns, it was just like an emotional anger that came out. This one is, they're all sad. It's always sad when a team is relocated from one city to another. I hate it. I always will hate it. Even if it makes sense, I'll hate it just because you've asked people to invest financially, emotionally, in a team. Like these aren't just, like, I know you hate the word franchises, and you've gotten me to feel that way as well. You're right. Like this is not just a Burger King opening up in your, you know, local shopping center. Like
right.
This is civic pride. This is a thing that like bonds cities together. So I hate it. I absolutely hate it, man. I always feel that way.
I think my problem is MLS trades so much on, oh, this is for the city, this is for the rivalry. They do so much in terms of amping up the fans and the fans' moment, like what they do with Atlanta, like what they've, like for instance, we talked about the New York Derby. NYCFC have released a video where it's like a letter to the city, where David Villa talks about, you know, connecting with the fans and, you know, trying to get amped up and hyped up for this New York Derby. And MLS trades or tries to trade so much on fan culture, and yet this just feels like the antithesis of that, where you can just up and leave. Because it feels as if really at the heart of it, the owners don't. The owners don't feel that way.
Agreed. That is how it looks.
Somebody once said, Andrew, just to finish on this, that a football club is a badge and the supporters. And that's it, really. Because owners can come and go, players can come and go, even stadiums can change. But it's a badge and it's the supporters. No more than that.
Yep. I love it. Great point. Friday, 10:30, late one for a game like this. LA Galaxy and LAFC. Obviously, the first two matches between these two are spectacular. You had the Zlatan debut. You had the Galaxy coming back in the second one from 2-0 down. Can the third one reach that bar? LAFC have won two straight, while the Galaxy have really been sputtering, actually. They've won just one in their last five. So we'll have to see. They've kind of like come back down to the pack a little bit, and the playoffs are, it's going to be an interesting playoff race, which leads to the third game here, or the next game I have here, Sunday at 9:30, Portland Timbers, Seattle Sounders, one of the most fun derbies every year. Seattle can't stop winning, JJ, six straight. They're unbeaten in their last nine. They're coming off a 5-0 beatdown of the aforementioned Galaxy, and all of a sudden, Seattle is right in the thick of this playoff picture, and it took this kind of effort for them to get back into it because they got off to such a poor start. So that Western Conference race is going to be really interesting to me.
Yeah, it is. And that was an LA Galaxy minus Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who wouldn't play on the turf surface there at Seattle, which was kind of an interesting side note to that game.
Yeah, I saw his comments about that. And I mean, he's not wrong.
He's but not wrong.
Sadly, when you come here, it's just like, it's kind of part of the deal. Like, there's no surprises. I mean, you know the teams have that. So, I don't know. Like, okay, you can complain about it, and maybe something at some point will get done, but you can't be surprised. This didn't sneak up on you.
No, but you can't be surprised that the players refuse either, because Thierry Henry would only play on turf if it was a playoff game where he had to play.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Portland, they had been on a similar streak. They had a 15-game unbeaten run, but that is in their rearview mirror now, as they have lost three straight. So you've got Seattle coming in red hot form, and you've got Portland who have really cooled off. We'll see if that holds to form in this one. Europa League qualifying Thursday at 1 o'clock. FK Saduva against Celtic. Oh, JJ, not the game that Celtic thought they were going to be playing in.
This was not in the script for Brendan Rodgers at all. When you think about the great European nights at Celtic Park, this is not one of them.
No, FK Saduva not doing it for you? Okay.
No.
Well, what about Thursday at 2 o'clock when Olympiacos face Burnley in the first leg of the Europa League qualifying match?
Well, that's a little bit more like it. Olympiacos have a, you know, fairly proud tradition in European competition. They're a regular. We're familiar with them. And I think Burnley are finally getting a little bit of a European trip that's more in keeping with what they were hoping for rather than a trip to Aberdeen.
Okay, well, if you like that, then you're going to love Thursday at 2:45 when Steven Gerrard's Rangers face FC Utah.
By the way, what a start. I know he hasn't, I suppose FC Utah and St. Mirren and Skopje and teams like that, they're not exactly the creme de la creme of European football, but it's been a good start for Steven Gerrard.
Yeah, by the way, if you're wondering, FC Utah is Romanian.
Right. They've just on Rangers, Andrew, it was interesting the other day, there was a little interview that BT Sport did with Steven Gerrard, and he talked about how he said a couple of interesting things. Well, first of all, Robbie Savage was interviewing him, and he talked about how you haven't been behind yet in a game, which is incredible. That's a really great start for Steven Gerrard. And then Steven Gerrard said something which really made no sense to me. He said, "We can't be obsessed by Celtic." I was like, you're a Glasgow Rangers manager. That is literally your job right now. You've been trailing behind. Celtic are going for like a record breaking 11 or 10 in a row, whatever it is. You need to be obsessed by Celtic. Nobody is buying that.
So can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
So when the day ultimately comes and Jurgen Klopp leaves Liverpool for Real Madrid, are you excited for Steven Gerrard's tenure as Liverpool manager, or are you worried that it could hurt his legacy with the club in some way? How do you feel about this eventual certainty?
Oh, it's absolutely happening. It's written in the stars. I hope it turns out better than the last returning player we had from Glasgow Rangers, who was, of course, Graeme Souness, who came back and was basically blamed for the dismantling of a championship-winning team. So. So there are echoes there, but I think Steven he's a little bit more to go before we can say he's definitely going to be Liverpool manager.
Well, in my mind, the contract has already been signed.
All right.
Speaking of the Premier League manager, EPL this weekend, Saturday, 10 a.m., Arsenal and West Ham. Another kind of tricky one for Arsenal. I'd expect them to win, but it's back-to-back London derbies for them, which is never easy. This is, man, the start that Unai Emery was given from the schedule makers was, they really did him no favors here. Pressure will start to build if he can't find a way to win that one. Sunday at 11, Newcastle and Chelsea. Oh, another tough one for Rafa, JJ.
Yeah, really tough. Returning to one of his old clubs, although it never really felt, I know he led them to Europa League glory eventually, but it never really felt like he was loved at Chelsea. But that is just so tricky for him. Really is.
Yeah,
and two former Napoli managers coming head to head.
Oh, good call. Good call. And then Monday, you close out your week at 3 p.m. Eastern time at Old Trafford with Manchester United and Tottenham. In what suddenly feels, like we mentioned earlier, like a really, really important game for Jose Mourinho's personal future.
It's like you said, Andrew, everything feels like a cup final now. It really does.
Yeah, everybody is ready to pounce. Serie A, a couple worth mentioning here, in a really nice looking weekend of games. Saturday at noon Eastern time, Juventus and Lazio. Lazio have been in the news for some of the wrong reasons. I should say their supporters have, their ultras have.
Again. It feels like it's every season.
No girls allowed, JJ. It's like straight out of the Little Rascals.
What do you mean?
Well, the story that the Lazio ultras and the Curva Nord, they believe that that is their sacred space and they do not want women in there. during matches. They issued before the team's opening Serie A match, which Lazio lost 2-1 to Napoli, a flyer was handed out. And it said, "The Curva Nord represents for us a sacred space, an environment with an unwritten code to be respected. The first few rows, as always, have been experienced like the trenches. In the trenches, we do not allow women, wives, and girlfriends. So we invite them to position themselves from the 10th row and back."
I mean, let's be honest. Those who stand on the Curva Nord, as fanatical as they are, they have some really warped views about not just this, but many different issues. Should we really be surprised by this?
No, I guess not. But it is still, it's still pretty disappointing. But yeah, I suppose that maybe it's not a total shock. We should say too, Juventus getting off to a winning start in the new Ronaldo tenure.
But no goal for Ronaldo.
No, not yet.
Well, I actually I went full hipster and I decided that, as you know, I know it's Ronaldo's debut and lots of people will be tuning in, but I went at the weekend, I watched Lazio-Napoli, Andrew, and I may have seen my favorite goal of the season scored by Immobile of Lazio. Just a long ball over the top. He's got three defenders on him and he turns so sharply. It was Keystone Cop stuff from the defenders, but it was a brilliant turn and he bends it into the top corner. It was one of the moments of the weekend.
Nice. And speaking of Napoli, who you mentioned there against Lazio from that game, they play Saturday at 2:30 against AC Milan, that one in Naples.
That feels like an old-school 1980s classic, Napoli-AC Milan.
Yeah, and there you go. That is what to watch for this upcoming weekend and midweek.
Yes. Now, we're a little bit tight on time, so I have reduced the mailbag to one email, and I will get back to a much fuller, broader, lustrous mailbag next week, but this was emailed to us by Kyle Newman, and I thought we'd just get a few thoughts on it. "Love the pod. Did you guys talk about the Man City documentary series All or Nothing? If you did already, now that it's out, have you guys started watching it? It's amazing. Very similar to Hard Knocks. Unprecedented access to Pep and the team. Thoughts on it?" Andrew, have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet. I can't wait to see it because I've heard, the things I've heard about it are really, really good. Obviously, it was a fascinating season for them, but it has already made waves because I saw that Jose Mourinho felt that Manchester City were acting in a classless manner, whether that be like some of the narration about the City United match. It talked about United in kind of, I guess, negative connotations about the park the bus style. And Jose Mourinho felt, he said, you know, you can buy players, you can buy titles, but you can't buy class, something to that effect.
Yeah. And he said he wanted royalties from it because he appeared that he gets mentioned so often.
That's actually funny.
Yeah. No, I've watched episode one and I have a few thoughts. So it's similar to Hard Knocks, but I'm not sure that I think Hard Knocks is better personally.
Okay.
I think the access in Hard Knocks, the Kyle says unprecedented access to Pep, maybe to Pep and Manchester City, but certainly we've seen documentaries like this down through the years. There's the one that I always talk about, which was An Impossible Job, which is full access to Graham Taylor and his team as they failed to qualify for USA 94. There's also Football Club for a Fiver, which is behind the scenes at Leighton Orient, which is absolutely fascinating because, again, it's a club that's struggling. And I honestly believe that the clubs that are struggling are in a moment of crisis. Those are always the best documentaries. But there's there's a ton of really good ones out there, more than you'd imagine, in fact. So it's not that unprecedented. I'll actually give you a full list of them next week.
I mean, it's no Being Liverpool.
Well, Being Liverpool, here's why Being Liverpool is better. Being Liverpool, and I've only watched one episode, so I'm not going to give my full take on this just yet, but Being Liverpool is much, much better for the simple reason is that it's so bad, it's good. Like, it is terrible, some of the things that happen. The way it's set up, it's just awful. And I like it because it shows a little bit of Brendan Rodgers. It shows a little bit of Ian Ayre. We kind of see the ego of the game. And I couldn't believe, like, when Being Liverpool was shot, I couldn't believe how bad it actually was. It was cringy stuff. It really, and I'm a Liverpool fan. but it was it fell into the category of so good because it's so bad. And I think this Manchester City one, I don't know. I mean, first of all, why wouldn't you have a narrator who's got a Manchester accent? I'm not saying full on Liam Gallagher, but why wouldn't you, like Sir Ben Kingsley? Again, it just has pretensions of illusions of grandeur about it. So, I'll have to watch another episode before I can give my full take on it. Okay, Andrew, we're going to bring it down the stretch with
red card.
Would you like to begin or shall I?
You can go.
My red card is, it's a, maybe a week old. It's from the Daily Mail, but I thought I'd read it because it's kind of funny. Bristol Rovers, somebody who do not come up regularly on this podcast. Bristol Rovers have launched an investigation into how clubhouse televisions showed adult channel Babe Station during halftime of Tuesday's Carabao Cup win against Crawley. Rover supporters, many of whom were children, were shocked to see the X-rated TV station rather than the usual halftime scores from around the country. The Sky Bet League One club has issued a statement saying the club believes that someone that was attending in the bar was using a universal remote device to affect the TV output.
How in the name of God can it be just that simple?
Yeah, that's the excuse. That's been put out there by Bristol Rovers. I don't think that red card requires much comment.
No, only that I would like you to remain with this story. I want to see how this one plays out and how that actually did happen.
All right.
I'm curious now.
We'll try and follow up next week.
Yeah, important. These are the important issues affecting lives around the world. Let's see, my red card. This is such a phony red card. What was the red card you did that one time, JJ? Was it Inzaghi because he was great at tennis?
It was Paolo Maldini. Where I was angry because he was successful still, even after he'd retired from football.
Yeah, my red card is sort of in that vein where I'm going to give it to people as a way of praising somebody else. Roy Lasseter, Chris Wondolowski, and Bradley Wright Phillips get my red card, but this isn't really about them, though. They get the unfortunate red because they're about to be blown away in the category of most MLS goals in a single season. Joseph Martinez notched his record-tying 27th goal over the weekend against Columbus in just his 25th game. It was also his 46th goal in 45 regular season MLS games, also breaking the record for most goals in a player's first two seasons. David Villa had that. This guy is just, he's on the most torrid streak right now. He's scored in 8 straight games, second longest in the league's history. By the way, he could have broken the record on a couple of occasions in that game against Columbus. He hit the crossbar in like the 68th minute. Then later in the game, he could have gone for goal, but instead he laid it off to Miguel Almiron to slot home. This guy, he's sensational. He cannot stop scoring, and that record is going to be shattered. He is going to set a new bar. That is inevitable now.
Would you like to hear the call for that goal?
Of course I would.
He's up against Lalas Abubakar. Joseph Martinez goes to the left. It's Martinez! 27 goal record! The Venezuelan has it!
Yeah, there you go.
How about
so
that?
Props to him. I mean, he's sensational, man. By the way, real quick, I do have one small honorable mention for a red card. Matthew Loughton of Burnley, what he did over the weekend stomping on Isaac Success's hand was so dumb. It was so petty. He was so lucky to not have been given a red card, but he does potentially face a retrospective ban for it, and he should be because it was – and his smug smile afterwards because he knew what he got away with, and he seemed so proud of himself. There's TV cameras always watching, man. He needs to get suspended for this because there was no reason for it. It was so childish. So they got to get him. They got to get him, JJ.
Yeah, it was particularly naughty. And yeah, he kind of, he had that smug expression as if I've got away with this. Can we just go back to the Atlanta, the Joseph Martinez story for a minute? Because, that was Kevin Egan of Fox on the call, and Dan Gargan, the former MLS player, he joined Kevin Egan on the call, Andrew, and I'll tell you, he proved himself to be more than just a commentator, but also a moral compass in these fraught times. Have a listen to this.
This right here, Jossie Zardes standing in the middle field completely naked is unacceptable.
Jossie Zardes standing in the middle field completely naked is unacceptable.
Yes, I would say that that is a fact. Standing in the middle of the field completely naked would be unacceptable.
This right here, Jossie Zarda standing in the middle field completely naked is unacceptable.
Thanks to Dan.
At least he didn't use the word literally. Like, that feels like a situation where somebody could have really had a bad misuse of, like, he's literally completely naked in the middle of the field. Like when people say, you know, oh my God, you know, LeBron James, he is literally on fire right now. No, well, no, he's not.
Well, well, Dan's call made me think of this.
We're streaking. We're going up through the quad to the gymnasium.
So Zardes was drunk. And he had just stumbled into the stadium.
Straight away, I'm thinking of a drunk Jossie Zardes in the middle of the field shouting,
"We're streaking! We're going up through the quad to the gymnasium!"
And of course, you know me, Andrew, things in my mind make me laugh, and I just started laughing uncontrollably, for really no reason. But nice. Dan Gargan is he is not just a co-commentator, he is a man of morals, Andrew, and I think that's important.
Yes, very nice.
Caught Offside's Man of the Match.
I'm going to go first on this one, Andrew. My Man of the Match is Marcelo Bielsa. The Leeds United manager has had a pulsating start to the season, and it's come as no surprise to him. He welcomed the early injection of confidence ahead of tonight's trip to Swansea. Bielsa said his expectations had not been surpassed by Leeds, opening their campaign with four straight wins. Now, four straight wins, okay, that's a good start. That's a run which made him the first head coach in the club's history to start his reign at Elland Road with so many victories back to back. I mean, Leeds are such a proud and storied club. I was really surprised that four straight victories would be enough to do that. By the way, really what's captured people who are, you know, casual championship watchers about Bielsa is the way he conducts his post-match interviews. Have you seen that?
No, I have not.
So Bielsa has not got English, well, he's not got very much English at all, but he is determined to learn it. So he has an interpreter with him. So the question is asked by the Sky Sports person, and it's asked through the interpreter, and then the interpreter repeats it in English for Bielsa, and Bielsa repeats it back to, repeats verbatim what the interpreter has just told him. Have a listen to this.
Marcelo, another outstanding win. What pleased you about that performance?
¿Qué le gustó de esta victoria? De esta actuación.
Un equipo combativo, concentrado.
A focused team.
A focused team.
A team that fought.
A team that fought.
It's been cracking people up over in England, although I actually think, I know it's not making for the most compelling TV, and it, you know, it makes the press conferences, I guess, something of a drudge, but at the same time, you've got to give him credit. He's not just speaking through the interpreter, he's having the interpreter speak it back to him, and he can repeat it so he can learn.
Yeah, you're right, they don't sound like the most enjoyable press conference to sit through, but if it helps him learn English, then I'm all for it.
Do you know who I spoke to yesterday at lunch?
No.
I spoke to golfer Colin Montgomery, and Colin Montgomery turns out to be a huge Leeds United fan. And we sat down and we talked about it. And this is one of the things he said. That shows his passion and commitment. That has got to be really encouraging for the fans, that he's here for the long term.
How did you come across Colin Montgomery?
Colin Montgomery was in Carragher's watching Liverpool versus Crystal Palace in New York City.
Really?
Yeah. And he is the nicest man. He is, I couldn't believe it, because he has this record of finishing second in majors, and you know, sometimes he's cut a frustrated figure in his own post-match press conference, or post-golf, post-tournament press conferences. But he came across as a really, really nice guy. Very nice man.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yes, indeed it is. What do you got?
My Man of the Match. This might be my favorite one ever, JJ. Supporters of SBV Excelsior in the Dutch Eredivisie. In the Rotterdam Derby over the weekend, Feyenoord and Excelsior face one another at De Kuip, Feyenoord's home ground. In the 19th minute, objects began to rain down from the visiting Excelsior away supporters. Now, years of bad behavior have conditioned us, not from Excelsior fans, but from fans in general, have conditioned us to believe that something terrible was happening when you saw these scenes. But that could not have been further from the truth. A huge number of children from Rotterdam's Sophia Children's Hospital had been invited to the match. They happened to be seated directly below the Excelsior fans' away section, and the Excelsior fans came armed and ready with hundreds upon hundreds of stuffed animals and other soft toys for the kids to take back with them. It was such a cool scene. So if we're going to point out the bad things that fans do, we damn well better point out the good ones. And this was one of the best that I've ever seen.
Ah, that's really, really nice. That is fantastic. I can only imagine if that was Lazio fans, they'd just drop wrenches and screwdrivers and just heavy machinery.
Yeah. And now it is worth mentioning that I think, AOG Den Haag, I believe they did the same thing at Feyenoord a couple seasons ago. It is something that has happened before. But man, if you haven't seen it, like there's plenty of, videos on YouTube of it happening, and it's really, really cool. By the way, if you were curious, in that game, Feyenoord won and Robin van Persie scored for them.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That was only a side story to what the Excelsior fans did. Really, really cool.
Well, I'm glad you've ended this podcast with a feel good moment, because let's be honest.
Whoa, it's crap. Whoa, it's bloody rubbish. Rubbish.
I know. It really, I hate this. I hate this. And we're going to have to do it again because you're going to Ireland next week, which I'm very happy for you. But the show suffers.
It does suffer. And you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking maybe we reconsider and you just do a short solo pod, something like that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because I can't do another one of these.
Oh, it's crap. Oh, it's bloody rubbish. Rubbish.
That would be unprecedented. And for all the people that you just scared away from listening to that solo Andrew podcast, just know, everybody, that has not been officially decided yet. We're going to have to talk about this first.
No, we will talk. We'll talk about it, but you could line up an interview or something, surely.
Oh, my God.
You know, I just...
So much pressure.
Yeah, I know. I hate that back-to-back weeks, but we don't really take many vacations. So I guess if you got to suffer it at the start of the season, sorry, guys, that's just the way it is. By the way, we will get on to your help of fans, which are piling up. I think we should stick to that date. It's going to be the international break. So right after Labor Day weekend, the pod that comes out that week, we're going to release an individual pod on our feed. We are going to give you all the clubs that you need. Those people who have been asking for us, not just to do an EPL one, but to do a La Liga one and a Serie A one. Are you crazy? Are you absolutely crazy? No. That we are struggling with the huge amount of wonderful reviews we've got, and we will get to them. So people, please just wait another couple of weeks. Just be a bit more patient. I will, when I come back from vacation, I promise you, I will deliver.
As will I.
Well, man, this has been fun. Even though you've been far away, this has been fun.
It always is. I love our time together.
It only remains for me to say this, I guess.
Take you later, fun boy.
And to do this. Take care, Andrew.
I'll see you.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.